This is Professor Allen, and welcome to the Quarter Bin. In every episode of this podcast, I will summarize, criticize, discuss, and review a single issue from my comic book collection, which I will select sort of at random. Any book from my comic book collection is eligible, as long as I paid no more than 25 cents for it. Was the issue worth 25 cents? Was it a bargain at 25 cents? Or was it still overpriced? Stay tuned and find out. For this 146th episode of the Quarter Bin, we are wrapping up our two-episode, four-issue look at another dead universe, this time the Topps Comics line of Jack Kirby-related comics. And this time, we're looking at Night Glider number one and Captain Glory number one, both again from Topps Comics, and both cover dated April 1993. But first, a little feedback. We spent some time last episode talking about possible rejiggering of the rules of the podcast. And I have another comment on that general topic from Michael Geist. Professor, I too have found it difficult to find 25-cent books in my area. There is a local thrift shop that will from time to time receive comic donations that end up in their 25-cent paperback section. A few months back, I was able to acquire a complete run of the 2014 Deathstroke, including the annuals, a solid run of Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps, and issues 8 through 12 of Wednesday Comics. You know, I have never found comics at a yard sale or a thrift shop, and yet I keep haunting them just in case. So those are not too shabby, Michael, and like you, I need to stay on the lookout. And on that topic of possibly adjusting the quarter bin rules, we got a very helpful suggestion from Paul Hicks of DCOCD. I think the mission of the Quarter Bin podcast should be comics that you can read and record about in the LCS for free. Well, the closest I could come is maybe I could just flip through the books in the store and take pictures of each page and then put it back on the shelf. Yeah, I can't see Jeff, the owner of World's Greatest Comics, having a problem with that. Thanks for that suggestion, Paul. Now, I spent so much time talking about those potential podcast changes last time that I did not talk about the issue from episode 144, Four Color Comics 1253, aka Spaceman number one. So first up, we'll talk about that issue. Sir Martin of Grey was fascinated to hear that to me, Spaceman and astronaut are not synonyms. Your secret alien identity is showing. I have to give Martin some credit on this one. This may just be a just me situation, because I was reading a prose sci-fi short story recently from the 50s, and in that, the astronauts were regularly called spacemen. So I have no excuse. Mike from Comics in the Golden Age said that this was a wonderful episode. I'm so glad you covered this issue. Anything from the late 1920s to the 60s about man reaching space fascinates me, no matter how off base or ridiculous it might seem today. Lizanne Oswalt, who has a YouTube page, wrote in on that one as well. Hi, Professor Allen. So that's how they saw space travel, huh? Weird. A negative wall in space. Also weird, if you think about it, that the good guys used negative power and the bad guys used positive. Were they emo aliens helping Earth? All right, L.A., that was a funny line. Titans from Greek myth as villains? That's interesting. So why didn't our hero tell his mom his dad was alive? That is an awesome question, too. And why didn't he send alien transmissions to her? Again, fair questions, Lizanne. All fair questions. Now, she did bring it back around to the issue of the types of comics we cover here. As for the price point, doesn't matter to me. That you can find a 50-cent comic nowadays is impressive. It's $5 for new ones. Oy! So, yeah, if it has two stories in it, that counts as a 25 cents a story. If it becomes too much of an issue, just call the show Reading Cheap Old Comics. There. Issue fixed. Can't wait to hear the next podcast. Well, Lizanne, thank you for solving that entire problem. I love the idea of the new name change, but I still can't see that pacifying some of our, how could I say this, more passionate and hard-headed listeners? No, I actually love that idea. I mean, look, anything is possible. Gene Hendricks noted one line in particular from that last episode, quoting Mia saying, "Everyone's opinion counts except Shag. He's from Florida." Now, as a recent transplant to the Sunshine State, Gene decided to not take offense at that. And that's a good call because, buddy, you haven't been there long enough to go native, okay? Now, last episode, we did start our look at the Kirbyverse issues, and Luke Giacchetti said that he remembered these Kirby books from Topps, but as he says, "I was too young to really understand who Jack Kirby was or why I should care. I suspect if I was a little more educated, I would have picked them up, eager to hear the episode." Kyle Benning posted a GIF. Yeah, I said GIF. Come at me, brah. He posted a GIF of Chris Hemsworth as Thor shouting, "Yes." So I think he was eager to listen as well. And Nathaniel Wayne, wrapping up his tenure as a listener of the year, wrote in, "Dear Professor, so I can't help but shake my head at the entire flowchart thing. It's the kind of thing I find funny and infuriating because the people behind it were this close to a revelation." He's referring to the inside cover of all these issues, which has a flowchart of the, whatever it was, 11, 12, 13 issues that made up this Secret City saga in the proper reading order with an arrow saying, "You are here." Nathaniel says, "They must have been thinking, our releases and the way the stories connect is going to be super confusing. We should include a flowchart so they can follow what's going on." And yes, of course, because that makes much more sense than maybe backing up and not making the whole thing such a cluster muck. Thank you, Nathaniel. Such a cluster muck in the first place. Yes, I know, it was the early 90s, so they were probably trend following as far as these interlocking new titles are concerned, but they had enough reflection to see that a problem existed, but preferred to band-aid it rather than fix it. And that's funny, but sadly funny. I was immediately reminded of how many video games being released now have different content, depending on where it's purchased, and even how much is paid for it, resulting in consumers and reviewers having to build spreadsheets to make sense of what's even included, all because the numbers were crunched, and it's more profitable in the short term to confuse people to the point that they give up and buy everything. Yep. That worked out so well for comics in the 90s. You keep on that planned video game industry. Sorry, this turned into something else. Geekily yours, Nathaniel Wayne. Now, since he is still in his tenure as Listener of the Year, Nathaniel is free to turn his emails into whatever he wants. Those are good points, but spoilers. We will revisit that flowchart situation later in the episode in the discussion and analysis section, and it actually will make a little more sense in this case. But in general, Nathaniel's points are certainly strong and well-made. And more broadly, thank you, Mr. Wayne, for not just this contribution, but for all your contributions and your service as Listener of the Year, your successor or successors, whoever they may be, have high standards to meet. Good work, my friend. Good work. That last episode received social media love from Derek William Crabb, who was a total fanhole, Christopher J. Warden, Clinton from Coffee and Comics, Pat Sampson from the Long Box Crusade, Christopher Willett, James Williams, Paul from the Collected Edition, Sir Iowa's Joe, Manuel Carmona from Truthful Comics, Jared Albrecht, the Yard Sale Artist, Jeremiah Jones Goldstein, the Notorious JJG from comics.blog, Farmer Carl, David Beyer, Mike from Justice's First Dawn, Kirk Spencer, Big Five Army, Mike Staley, and Drew from Comics for Fun and Profit and the office around the corner and down the hall from me on campus, and the Countess and Count of the Sutherlands from the Rad Adventures Network. Thanks to everybody for your support. Let's take a quick break, play a promo from a show that just recently celebrated its 10th podiversary. Congratulations, Miss Stella. And when we come back, we'll be back with Night Glider number 1 and Captain Glory number 1.
Sawate. My name is Stella, and I am the host of Backroll to Oracle, the Barbara Gordon podcast. Backroll to Oracle is a podcast dedicated to Barbara Gordon, the first woman to hold the mantle of Backroll for an extended period of time, roughly 1967 to 1988. The goal of Backroll to Oracle is to examine the character's history from her first appearance as Backroll and continuing through her tenure as Oracle. Each episode looks at a vintage issue of Detective Comics or Batman, as well as other books like Justice League and Freedom Fighters, and modern issues of Batgirl and Birds of Prey. I also keep track of news involving Batgirl and other members of the Bat family, and I have a revolving series of segments like Babs in the Tube, which highlights appearances of Babs in TV and film, Shipper Spotlight, which looks at a variety of comic and pop culture couples, gives their history, and determines whether they are hot or not, Reading with Stella, which could be described as an audio drama, or just me reading a book that relates to Babs or doesn't, and of course, the mainstay literature recommendation. I have been blessed to interview writers Scott Beatty and Chuck Dixon on their Backroll Year One work, Brian Q. Miller on his Backroll run, Dwayne Swierczynski and Christy Marks on their separate Birds of Prey work, and the creators and actors of the Backroll Spoiled, the web series. I hope to interview more creators and actors in the future. My goal, most importantly, is to make a fun, entertaining, and thoughtful show that people enjoy and from which they learn. Find the show online at thebatmanuniverse.net and iTunes, and follow the show on Facebook and Twitter at Batroll to Oracle. Thank you, and fly on, Babs lovers.
And we're back. And first up on today's double feature, we get Night Glider number 1, which had a cover price of $2.95, which means I got this book at just over a 91% discount. The cover, by Jack the King Kirby, shows a purple and red background with the appropriate amount of Kirby dots, and most of the cover is a woman flying downward. We're seeing her from the back, but her neck is craned and we can see her face. She has some white markings on the suit and a white headpiece, and white webbing connecting her arms to her legs and her legs to each other. Think Flying Squirrel. Much more webbing than early Spidey. We mentioned the roadmap on the inside front cover, which Nathaniel Wayne referenced, and the You Are Here arrow has indeed moved. Night Glider was created by Jack Kirby and developed by Roy Thomas. This specific story, She Glides in Beauty Like the Night, was plotted by Roy Thomas, scripted by Jerry Conway, and arted by Don Heck. The story starts with an earthquake. In San Francisco or Los Angeles, this wouldn't even rate a blurb on the evening news. But this isn't California, it's Michigan. And this isn't LA, it's Chicago. Yes, I read that right. They put Chicago in Michigan. Because I know, flyover country is all the same to you East Coast comic elites. Not only is that a geographic mistake, it's a moral failure? Because as a proud Ohioan for just a touch over two decades now, I recognize the biggest mistake here, perhaps you didn't, and that is that Chicago as a city is great. And there's nothing great in Michigan. And yes, podcaster Mike Peacock from Justice's First Dawn is very good, and he's from Michigan, but nothing else comes close. Chicago? Wonderful. Michigan? Come on, I mean, Michigan? What are we talking about here? Okay. Deep cleansing breaths. Back in Chicago, Illinois, the shifting of the ground sends a tremor to the bottom of a crevice that has opened in Grants Park. And in the secret city, stirred by those tremors, a sleeper wakes. And with her waking, neither the city nor this world will ever be the same. She breaks loose and needing air, needing sky, lets warm currents lift her upward. She bursts into the air, joyous at how good it feels to fly swifter and higher and farther than any of my race have flown before. I can't wait till the rest of my platoon sees me. But the city below her is not Gazra. And the huge jet flying right at her is not a bird. She is lucky to not get hit, but the close call stirs her mind. I am Glida, second in command of the Night Flight Patrol. I'm on a mission for the Council of Scientists. A mission to the future. At that point, she realizes that this is the future, and that she has slept for the intended 15,000 years. She scares a window washer off his high-rise rig, but catches him safely. By then, a police helicopter has arrived on scene. She buzzes close to it to investigate. But the whirling rotors knock her out of the sky. She hits the street hard, and a policeman comments that he's surprised that she's not busted up, and then even more surprised when she does try to sit up. But she can't understand his words, and in the pain, she does pass out. And waking up in the hospital, we see that she has blondish red hair under that night glider suit, and she gets a visitor, a woman claiming to be her lawyer. Glida is released, and we learn that this woman is in fact Drina. And Glida is then introduced to Tomark. Welcome to the 10th Age, citizen. These two are ninth men, like Glida, who also recently awoke, but they were revived a year ago and have learned the language and ways of modern man. And now that Glida is here, we three will assume our destined place as the rightful rulers of this 10th age of mankind. But Glida wants to protect humanity, not rule over it. So they fight. And by the way, they are now in a flying car, and she jumps out of this vehicle, sending a "To the pit with you!" over her shoulder. We get a pretty cool mid-air fight scene, which ends with Glida saving a young girl. The people around applaud her heroics. They laugh and applaud. She flees, exhausted and confused, and seeks out the only place she knows to rest. Back in the crevice, the secret city is still the only haven I've got. When she returns, she runs into a dude with a purple and red suit, and they fight. This is Bombast, who we met last episode. But a hand reaches in to separate the pair of battling ninth men. "Stop this madness, Bombast and Glida, or you'll both answer to me, Captain Glory." The end. Now, to me, it makes sense to do the synopsis for the next issue right here, and then talk about them both together in the analysis section. So with that, let me say this. Captain Glory, number one, had a cover price of $2.95, meaning I also acquired this book at nearly a 91.5% markdown. The cover, again by the King, has a similar background to the prior one. This one is purple, with accents of orange. And the figure coming at us is in a costume that somehow mixes red, yellow, white, blue, stripes, stars, and an eagle. It doesn't totally work, but it is completely and identifiably Jack Kirby. The You Are Here arrow has moved again on the inside cover. Again, Captain Glory was created by Jack Kirby and developed by Roy Thomas. This story, The Power and the Glory, was written by Thomas with art by Steve Ditko. And the story starts with a little history lesson. In 1673, exploring a vast lake, a couple of Frenchmen named Marquette and Juliette passed a spot the local tribes called Chequagou. The name has mutated a bit since then. Today's natives call the place Chicago. It used to be America's undisputed second city. Till Los Angeles got uppity. Now it's third in size. When a sudden, violent, and utterly unanticipated earthquake makes a brief bid to knock it down another peg or two. Deep down a brand new hole in Grant Park, two birds have flown a most unique coop, and a third is hammering at its transparent portal, making his bid to be. Then we turn the page, and we hear Captain Glory's translated shout on a splash page. Free! He notices that bombasts and Glida's cells are empty. He then flashbacks 15,000 years ago, back to when he was named Kelton and lived in the wondrous sprawling city of Gazra. He was a warrior in battles against savages who sought to pummel the city down to their primitive level. Along with the two classes of warriors, night gliders and hurlers, Kelton led his people to victory. After a victory, Kelton meets the Speaker and General Ordiz and Chief Scientist Roag, who all explain to him the process that we've talked about for two issues now. Of the three who have been selected for the cryogenics and the 15,000-year wait and serving humanity and all of that. And he prepared for the Triad Project, but he sensed disapproval from the scientist and the general. And as the day approached, Kelton was kept from going into one of the areas of the complex. Now, as his thoughts return to the present, Kelton realizes that everyone he ever knew, everyone he ever loved, has been dead for 15,000 years. And recognizing where he is, Kelton seeks out that secretive location, and 15,000 years after being denied entry, he enters. The site of the mammoth chamber in which he finds himself answers no questions, but raises many. He hears a ruckus above him and climbs to the surface, finding himself in a zoo. He battles a gorilla and then is interviewed on TV and approached by the police, but he doesn't understand anybody. And he flees, running across the tops of automobiles. The TV journalist manages to find him again and dubs him Captain Glory. But before anything else happens, he is snagged by cables from an unusual type of chopper. The police recognize that nothing they can throw at it is going to bring him down. Inside the strange flying craft, Captain Glory comes face to face with General Ordiz and Dr. Roag and a number of other scientists and assistants, all of them considered the Speaker a fool, and that more ninth men needed to be saved than just the three that he had planned. He was a fool to want the remainder of our race to help the tenth men and not rule them as well. Glory thinks that ruling the tenth men is a terrible idea, so they fight on the ship. Before he could be overpowered by the sheer numbers against him, he rolls off the ship and crashes through the roof of a poor, unsuspecting family thousands of feet below. They recognize him from TV. And again, he flees. In short order, he's back at the zoo and leaps into the unguarded crevice in the earth. But instead of rest, He walks into the middle of a pitched battle between Glyda and Bombast. Both are assuming that the other is a servant of Ordiz and Roag, and as such, are beating each other up with righteous fury. But Captain Glory steps between them, separating them. "Stop it, both of you. Stop this madness, Bombast and Glyda, or you'll both answer to me, Captain Glory." The end.
Evolution is a constant, even for the world's greatest superheroes. Founding members have departed, new members have stepped in to fill the ranks, and their final memories of Happy Harbor are of a stunning betrayal and the loss of their secret sanctuary. But there is only one place to go for the Justice League of America as they march into the Bronze Age of comics, straight up! More precisely, 22,300 miles up above the Earth. Welcome to a bold new era for Justice's First Dawn, a classic Justice League of America podcast. Your host, Mike Peacock, invites you to make yourself comfortable for over 100 issues in their very first annual with the League as they enter the much-beloved satellite era. Here's a brief sampling of the thrills and chills that await your podcast catcher, a veritable who's who of new members, such as the Elongated Man, Red Tornado, Zatanna, and Firestorm. Surprise membership returns, more epic team-ups with the Justice Society of America, along with appearances by the Legion of Superheroes, the All-Star Squadron, the New Gods, and even a combination of the DC Universe's greatest heroes of history. A galaxy of superstar writers such as Denny O'Neill, Len Wein, Steve Englehart, and Jerry Conway. The longest artistic run in the book's history by the astonishing Dick Dillon, along with contributions by Neil Adams, Don Heck, George Tuska, Rich Buckler, and George Perez. All this and more surprises and excitement await you in this new phase of Justice's First Dawn. Come along with television's era-certified super friends at classicjla.podbean.com or subscribe to the show via iTunes. Oh yeah, and there's the debut of Ultra. Yay!
And we're back. Again! I'm not sure that last time I explained the concept of this line of books, this Kirbyverse from Topps. This line stemmed from character designs and story concepts that Kirby, at this very late point in his life, had in his files, and unrealized projects, preliminary sketches, that sort of thing. Some of them were designed for Pacific Comics, which went defunct in the 1980s. And another bit of information I found online was this, and I have lost track of which specific site this bit of info was from, but it's that Kirby's contributions may have been drawn in the 1970s. One historian notes that the 70s was the flowering of Jack's interest in the paranormal. Freed from the restraints of collaborators, Jack delved into these themes with gusto. He developed Satan's Six around this time, although it didn't see the light of day until the Topps Kirbyverse campaign in the 1990s. I also saw a note that Kirby himself wrote and drew 8 pages of the Satan's Six premiere issue, which was then interlaced with story pages by writer Tony Isabella and artists John Cleary and Armando Gill. Now, in terms of the issues that we've covered in full in these last two episodes, I did read that the covers of Bombast, Captain Glory, and Night Glider were built around pre-existing Kirby character designs. So they might not have been originally conceived of as cover images, but were repurposed for that. But they do work, at least in terms of the two we covered this episode. And, to be honest, it gives them a chance to put a big circle on the cover containing Jack's signature, because he did the original art that ended up on the covers. Another site I saw described this line and also talked about how the books did sales-wise. The concept itself saw Topps lease Kirby's name alongside the characters and saw the line referred to as the Kirbyverse. It was initially seen as a creative and financial failure. The line consisted of leftover concepts Kirby had developed years prior, which I think is a bit of a harsh way to put it, but... and generated low sales and minimal reader interest, finding a niche only with hardcore Kirby fans. In other words, there's a reason you can so easily find these in cheap bins, often still polybagged with a card. Oh, sorry, according to the cover, the books each had a Super Deluxe Kirby Chrome trading card inside. I just hope you all appreciate the financial sacrifices I made in opening these bags to do the last few episodes. I mean, I guess M can kiss those fully paid for grad school plans goodbye, because I've opened the bag on these books and exposed those collector's cards to the harsh elements. But for you lovely listeners, I am willing to take that financial hit. I was actually glad to see that these books did in fact come out before Kirby's passing, by about a year or so. I don't know how involved he was in the negotiations of this, but it does make me feel better to know that at least he was the beneficiary of the money coming in from this deal, as opposed to something that happens in the prose fiction side of publishing a lot, and which I've talked about when we covered some Techno Comics books here on the Quarterbin. On the subject of licensed comics, where an author's publishing life continues long after they've shaken off this mortal coil. And those are, more often than not, almost exclusively, I'd say, those are deals made by the estate or the heirs to be honest, generate new royalties off the name of the dead creator. And these were Jack's ideas, Jack's sketches, and like I said, most importantly, he was alive at the time of this deal. So I feel better about that aspect of this line of comics. As opposed to, on a related note, I was in a bookstore recently and saw a brand new novel co-written, quote-unquote, by Stan Lee. And that just kind of bummed me out. Because, of course, Stan didn't co-write the novel. It's a way for his heirs or estate to earn some new money on his name. And I don't really blame them. I don't think, you know, their relative is an asset. And if that asset can earn them some money, they should use that. And I don't begrudge or blame the co-author either, who has probably paid a decent flat fee to write the novel. That's often how these arrangements work. Maybe there were ideas that can be traced back to Stan, notes somewhere, conversations, a file, an outline. But the credited co-author, obviously she did the heavy lifting on the book. Again, a paycheck is a paycheck, and a high-profile gig can't help but help her career. I don't even begrudge the publisher. Again, they're doing what they can to produce a work that they think will sell. And there's nothing wrong with that. I think mostly what makes me sad is that many people will buy the book. And no, I don't remember what it's called. I don't really remember any reviews. I know nothing of it other than I saw Stan's name on the cover. And I flipped to the inside back cover just to confirm that it was, in fact, our Stan Lee. And it was. So again, the concern I have is that people will buy the book and think that Stan wrote it, when he didn't. Like many of the problems with a market economy, it all goes back to us, as consumers, as customers, to what we buy. Publishers do this with many, many authors producing books ghostwritten by others, because it's what we buy. Where there's a problem, that problem is usually us. But again, that's not an unusual scenario in the book publishing world. But circling back around to these actual comics that we're covering, that seems to not have been the case here. It seems to have been a straightforward licensing deal, licensing the characters from a creator while that creator was still alive. And to me, that makes a big difference, and so I feel totally okay about that. In terms of the issues themselves, I do need to address that idea of the spreadsheet on the inside cover, what Nathaniel Wayne wrote in about. And as much as I agree with him in principle, and I do, in this case, the flowchart, the reading order, it makes sense. Because as you may have noticed, Bombast, Night Glider, and Captain Glory take place simultaneously and all end at the exact same point, with Glory interrupting the fight between Glida and Bombast. So you do want to read all three of these issues first before continuing into the Secret City Saga series. And that's what the flowchart was, I think, designed to demonstrate. So yes, it's complicated, and it's more than a mite convoluted, but there is some logic to the complication and to the convolutedness. And I do really like the concept of these three issues. And to me, this is all credit to Roy Thomas. And that is the telling of this interlocking origin story from three different perspectives. And you do get each character's individual backstory and origin. But in each one, you get a little different look at the backstory of the Ninth Men of Gazra, of the political machinations, and of those who defied the plan and went into cryosleep along with the three designated heroes. So between these three issues, you piece together that whole backstory. So what we end up with at the end is, of course, our three heroes fighting. And why do they do that? Because comics. But I assume in the moments after these issues end, they become allies and take on the general and the lead scientist and all those who would rule over us as Tenth Men. And so, I think that these stories lacked a little bit of oomph here and there, a little sparkle, a little something to set them apart. But I do think that in concept, they're an interesting accomplishment, bringing the three stories to a single conclusion. I wasn't expecting that at all. I was shocked when I saw it in Night Glider, and then I chuckled in admiration when I saw it coming in Captain Glory. So to me, the way these three issues end, that's a case of well done, comics professionals. And three quick things that I'll mention here that I liked about these. One, that they take place in Chicago, not in New York, not on the West Coast. And yes, comic writers from the coasts could do to learn a little Midwestern geography, but setting a book in our world and in some place where you don't often see comics set, I liked that. And as we have mentioned on many recent episodes of the Quarterbin podcast, I really like sci-fi in my comic books. And yes, this one does take place in our world, right in Chicago, Michigan. In our real time, but the setup is complete Golden Age sci-fi. An advanced, ancient civilization in the center of the Earth? Oh yes, I am up for this. And third, I'm an unapologetic fan of Steve Ditko and his art, and it was great to see him do the Captain Glory art. Any chance to see his work is a good thing for me. And by this point in his career and in his life, he wasn't doing big two work. But he did occasionally pop up in odd places in the indie world. I haven't read the next issues of the Kirbyverse line yet, but I have a few, like I said. And I'm pretty sure that Ditko did at least some of the art on the Secret City Saga series. And I'm looking forward to digging into those sometime, probably in January 2020, so stay tuned to a comics reading journal for that. And getting to this point, having read the three books and really wanting to get into the Secret City Saga, that is definitely going to affect my verdict on these books. The verdicts on Night Glider 1 and Captain Glory 1. These are not great books by any means. Don't let me sound like that's what I'm saying. But they are fun reads, interesting sci-fi background, and the Kirby designs and covers add something special to them. I am glad I found these and read these. These are solid quarter bin deals. That wraps up our coverage of Night Glider 1 and Captain Glory 1, bringing episode 146 to a close. And that brings our coverage of the Kirby line of Topps Comics to a close, joining other dead universes such as Amalgam, Milestone, Marvel's New Universe, The Ultraverse, Vertigo, and Techno Comics. These are all lines that I do not envisioning us returning to on this show. Like I said, listen to an upcoming Comics Reading Journal episode, and there will probably be some more Topps Kirbyverse content coming there in the not-too-distant future. But over here, next time, we're going back to our traditional, old-school quarterbin approach of looking at just one comic on an episode. And for episode 147, that one comic will be Batman 266 from DC Comics, of course. Cover dated August 1975. If you have any questions or comments about this issue or the episode or the podcast in general, feel free to contact me. Until next episode, I'm Professor Allen, and I'll see you in the quarter bin. The Quarter Bin Podcast is part of the Relatively Geeky family of podcasts. Show notes and links are available at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com, where the podcasts Uncovering the Bronze Age and Short Box Showcase also make their home. Links to Facebook and Twitter are there as well. Feedback for the show is welcome at relativelygeeky@gmail.com. And if you like what we've got going here, please leave a review and a rating in iTunes. It'll help more people discover the show. Thanks again for listening.